You're listening to a Bookmark podcast. For rights reasons, we've had to shorten or omit some of the music chosen by our guests, but we hope you still enjoy listening.
Bookmark with Lee Chambers on Cambridge 105 Radio.
With Heffer's Bookshop, the great Cambridge bookseller since 1876.
Our aspirations, rather than books.
Hello and welcome to Bookmark on Cambridge 105 Radio with me, Lee Chambers. This is the show that talks about books and writing with a local slant. And on Bookmark today, our studio guest is Ruth Figgis, talking about her debut novel, Magnetism. And we'll also hear from poets Aphrodite Nikolova and J.S. Watts. But first of all, Ruth, welcome to Bookmark.
Thank you. Nice to be with you.
Nice to have you here as well. Now, our other guests, as I said, are poets. You've written a novel. Have you ever written poetry?
Some very bad poetry, and now and then I'll have a go at it, but it's not very good.
But language, dialogue rips off your page of your novel. I mean, it really does zip off. I noticed in a previous life you were a clinical audiologist. Am I trying to overinterpret here by saying you listen to what, you know, you've got an ear, as it were, for what people say?
Yeah, I think by personality and also by training, I pay attention to sound, I pay attention to words and the sound of words and what people are saying and what they're not saying when they're not saying something too. So.
Yes, the gaps in between what people are saying. And how did you move from clinical audiology to writing?
Oh, well, I was became a senior manager in the NHS and then... I've been writing really for very many years. I've been writing since I was a little kid, so I've been writing a long time. And then I had the opportunity to take a job which gave me more time to write, which is what I do now.
Excellent. Well, we'll give you a proper introduction in just a moment, but we're going to listen to your first choice of music now, which is Have You Ever Seen the Rain by Creedence Clearwater Revival. Why this one?
There's something about this song that demonstrates a kind of a hopeful yearning. That's what I think it's about. And the time when it was written was a big time of change. And I think it's relevant today and it's always makes me feel something.
Have you ever seen The Rain by Creedence Clearwater Revival? The first choice of music on Bookmark today from our studio guest, Ruth Figgis. Ruth has an MA in creative writing from the University of Sussex. Her fiction has won or been shortlisted for the Bridport Prize 6 times, and her story, The Coffin Gate, was broadcast on Radio 4. Magnetism is her debut novel. Umi Serna said of it, it's psychologically acute, perceptive and witty, makes you laugh out loud and wince at the same time. And Patrick Gale said, Ruth Figgis demonstrates how to make a story. I agree with both of those reviews, actually. I really, really enjoyed this. And Umi's comment about wincing and laughing at the... Yes, definitely uncomfortable but enjoyable reading. Ruth, for people who haven't read Magnetism, can you tell them a bit about it?
Magnetism is a book that spans a long period of time, so it's about 50 years it spans, and it's a story told backwards about a mother and a daughter. And you hear it from the first-person point of view of the daughter, and it's there's lots of gaps. So it's a novel that's an episodic novel, so it's told backwards in this episodic fashion. And you find out about why they turned out to be the way they are, why their relationship is as it is, And I hope that it demonstrates a kind of a warmth between them that is unique to mother-daughter relationships.
Yes, mother-daughter relationships. It's a rich seam, isn't it?
It is indeed. Yeah.
Why backwards? Was it always going to be told about? I mean, it reminded me a little bit, and I'm guessing you've heard this before, of Betrayal by Harold Pinter, where you see the end in the beginning and vice versa.
I think the story. When you're thinking about how to structure a novel, you're thinking about point of view. One of the things that's important to think about is making sure that the structure suits what you're trying to get the reader to understand about it. So the thing about the relationship is that by telling it backwards, you peel away all the layers that they've accumulated over time, and you get back to the core of who they are as people. So and I wanted the reader to have a kind of an engaging ride with the story, to learn about these people, but also to have enough space to fill in the gaps, to think about how things have happened. So by telling it backwards, you know more than the characters do, but you're with them in the experience. So that was my intention anyway.
And it's very challenging, obviously, for a reader. Yeah. And a writer. Let's start with the writer first. How did you write it? Did you write it that way?
I didn't write it chronologically. I wrote, and it's not all chronologically backwards, because it jumps a bit at the beginning and then it picks up the story at the end. I didn't write it chronologically. I started with really the middle. The middle was On Becoming a Fish was the first thing that I wrote in this. And it's... and then what happened was I pieced together other stories about these same characters and realised that there was a timeline to it. And then nearer the end, I realised there were some gaps that I needed to fill in to make it make sense. So that's kind of how I did it.
And did you know at the end or the beginning what was going to happen?
Yeah, I always knew that the mother would die. I knew that that was going to be a big challenge. And that would in some way change things forever. So I did know the end from the beginning in that sense. It was an interesting discovery, and it was great fun to write. It was just fun and enjoyable. But it took a bit of piecing together at the end, and it's not necessarily the way I'd recommend writing something. But anyway, that's how this happened.
Well, it's very enjoyable to read. But yeah, as a reader, it is challenging, because you have to remember what's gone afterwards and gone before, if you know what I mean. Presumably, as a writer, you're aware of the situation you're putting the reader in, and you try and make it easier for them.
Yeah, some of the things I did to try and make it easier was, you've got the year at the start of each chapter, which I hope was helpful. But the other thing is that I tried to root it in historic events and the time period, to give a sense of the time, and the voices of the characters are to reflect their ages, so you can see them at different stages. And obviously the historical events are also there in the background, not too much in the fore, but they're there so that you can kind of ground it.
Yeah, and it is a period of massive historic change, isn't it? It's the furthest back you go, am I right in thinking it's 1961 up to 2015. So that is a massive period of social change, as well as political change.
So the mother is going through a period of change. So this, the women's lib thing comes into the story in some of the chapters, and she's trying to discover who she's going to be. The role of women changed enormously. Societal changes with behaviour and what was acceptable and what wasn't, and whether or not they would have ended up in this situation if it had been a current story is quite different than then.
And it's set in America. Was that you grew up in America, so was that always going to be the
case? Yeah, I grew up in America. I mean, I was born in Oxford, and we moved to the States. We moved back and forth a few times, but I grew up there. I spent my formative years there. And the thing about, I think it's an American story because of there's something about the big, vast area that gives you scope for exploring things. And some of the things that they experience are big and expansive. And so that's why I think it belongs there.
And so the obvious question, given that you grew up there, how autobiographical is it?
Yeah. Well, I'm a woman with a mother. this character doesn't have children. I do have two sons, and I'm happily married. And she isn't. But anyway, so some of it is autobiographical in terms of the aging and that sort of thing, but some of it isn't. So it's fiction. It's made up.
And as you say, you're covering massive issues in there. You look at mental health, infertility, homosexuality, single parenthood. But these are all in there. They're not obviously plunked. What I like is they're not obviously plunked in there as issues. They arise. Yeah. From people's interactions with one another.
Yeah, and I think, you know, a long life, lots of things can happen in a long life. One of the things in the structure of the story, too, is that people don't always end up where they expect to be. So when you go back in time and you see this girl's expectations of how her life is going to be and then how it ends up being, it's quite different. And I think life takes us different places, and sometimes as you get older, doors close as well as doors opening, different doors open. So I think that's part of it as well.
And we're going to hear from J.S. Watts in just a moment about her pamphlet, The Submerged Sea. You live by the sea now.
I do. I live in Sussex by the sea, and it's lovely.
Yes, how lovely. You've come to landlocked Cambridge. Thank you very much. Yes, well, let's move now to J.S. Watts. She's a poet and novelist. Her debut poetry collection, Cats and Other Myths, was a Poetry Kit Book of the Month, as was her 2016 collection, Years Ago You Coloured Me. Her poetry pamphlet, The Submerged Sea, was published earlier this year. As the title suggests, it explores many seas, both literal and metaphorical. And I asked her to talk me through a few of those when I met her.
There are a lot of different aspects of the sea. I guess the collection's a little bit more than just the sea. So you've got the sea around the British coast, which is the first poem, which kind of looks at nighttime sea in Britain and what's lurking there. You've got the real sea, the sea off the coast of Weymouth where the Purbeck Isle went down a few years ago. You've got the sea around the coast of Japan when the tsunami hit. So you've got all those seas, but you've got historical seas in there as well. Because I suppose at the basis of it all, the collection's about humankind's relationship to the sea and the sea's relationship to the world at large. So technically, I guess you've got waters of the globe there.
Well, what's the globe? And there seems to be a theme emerging in some of the poems about moving from the sea onto the land, that transition that man-made or that creatures made, mythical or real.
I'm hoping it's a complex, albeit very brief, pamphlet. And so the idea was to look at the sea, different aspects, different parts of the globe, but at different times. So it is the development. If you believe the current thinking, everything came from the sea, the land, humankind. But the sea has evolved over millennia. So where I live down in South Cambridgeshire, I can see the Thurfield Heath, which is chalkland, which would have once been sea, but which is now very much landlocked. So it's looking at the sea geographically, it's looking at it metaphorically, but it's certainly looking at it historically over the lifetime of the planet.
And you called this a pamphlet. Mm-hmm. It's not a chapbook or a book. It is a pamphlet, although it's, you know, quite weighty. There's so many more opportunities publishing-wise for poetry these days, and you don't have to have a big, thick collection.
That's true. If I intentionally didn't want a big, thick collection, I am actually working on a big, thick collection. But this was, as I said, looking at the sea, and I thought, well, actually, who wants 60 poems about the sea, even if it is metaphysical and metaphorical? Possibly by the 59th, you're going to get a tad bored. So I wanted something that was short. I might call it a pamphlet. Americans call it a chapbook. I'm not quite sure where pamphlets end and chapbooks begin. It's a small collection, and intentionally so, because I wanted it short and sharp.
And as a collection, was it written as a collection, or are these poems that have been around, some of them for a couple of years, or did you sit down and think, I'm going to write a collection about the sea?
It started off just poems I'd written at various times. I mean, ironically, for someone that always lived in a landlocked county, I was born kind of West London, was Middlesex, which is a very much a landlocked county. Then I moved up to Hertfordshire, which doesn't have a coastline. And now I live in Cambridgeshire, which is lacking a coastline. Ironically, I've always been fascinated by the sea. I think possibly because the sea was something I only ever saw as a child. So it was special. It was holidays. It was visits to the family. It was treats. So I've always had an interest in the sea. So some of these poems have just emerged over time. And then you start to look and think, oh, what am I doing? Oh, there's a pattern developing here. So certainly the last two, which I suppose are almost the title poems, Songs from the Submerged Sea, More Songs from the Submerged Sea, was actually written for the pamphlet. It was a conscious, yeah, what have I got now? This is a conclusion to it. So some of them have been specifically put in because they fit, but others, yes, over a period of several years, they've evolved.
And does that often happen, that you'll maybe write a poem and then you'll realise that somehow it connects with a poem that you wrote 2 years previously, or do you go through phases of writing poetry about particular themes or things?
I don't consciously go through phases about writing poetry about particular themes, but when I look back at what I've written, I clearly have one or two ideas drumming on in the back of my mind, so the themes do go through. I tend to kind of write poems at the time, whatever they've been spurred on by. And then when it comes to creating collections and things, I kind of like, oh, where are the patterns? And then I might write a specific poem to fit in with it.
And I suppose the sea is a rich subject matter, isn't it? Because there's all the myths about it. It's life giver, but it's life destroyer as well. I mean, once you tap into a subject like that, it's really, for you, creative gold.
It is. And it's not just the myth, it's the actuality of it, because, yeah, if you look at the science, it is a life giver. We survive on the sea. If it wasn't there, this planet would not be shaped the way it was. But what it gives, it destroys, hence poems of Japan, which are based on the tsunami that destroyed a large chunk of Japan and many of its people. Yes, when you then add in the myths and legends that go with it, whether it's Merman, whether it's Lyonesse and the Lost Lands, as I think it says at the back of the pamphlet, I mean, there's more of this world that's in water and underwater than there is on land. So given that, there's an endless supply of stuff to write about.
It's quite a challenge, though, linguistically, using a different vocabulary, describing waves, describing water without being repetitive.
Yes, I guess to a certain extent it's like any themed poetry that, if you're not careful, you get some words that really work, and then you just keep using them over and over again. And meanwhile, your reader goes, I think I've read this before. But again, it's part of the challenge as a writer to be able to write something that's on the same topic but is fresh, whether it's looking at it from a different angle, whether it's using different vocabulary, whether it's using a different tone or a rhythm to convey the differences of that one object.
So this has just come out. What's next for you?
I've got lots of things on the go at the present. As you know, I'm a novelist as well as a poet. So my next novel, which is number 3, but is number 2 in the Witchlight series, is currently sitting with the publisher, has been written, so we're waiting on a publication date. I'm actually writing the 3rd of the Witchlight series, and I am working on the next full collection. Yeah, a fair bit still on the go.
Good, very busy. And you're going to read some poetry for us now?
I'll start off actually with the first poem in the pamphlet, because I've alluded to it, which is a look at the British coastline. And it's called Night Notes on Sea, British Coast. For these notes, taken down cautiously and in a whisper, we are talking British Sea, the chill and often fierce waters that encircle us. Elsewhere, the Maldives, Caribbean, Puerto Rico, the night sea glows and sparkles, flaunting its luminescence in alluring shades of blue and turquoise and skin-warm starry nights. In Britain, when night falls, the sea shuts down, finito, fade to black. In daylight, it's a tease, a changeable creature of moods and tantrums, twinkling with diamonds one moment, lashing the shore another. It's blue, it's green, it's brown, grey, slate, pewter, and all the shades in between. But at night, the lights go out, unless the coast provides them, and then it's unsubtle fairy lights, reflecting on the black sleekness that prowls beneath. The British Sea at night is black, nocturnal. It does not crave attention, just swallows the sun and lies there, waiting in the dark. And then you wonder why and for what. Next one I'm going to read, I think he is particularly relevant at present. I mean, we're hearing a lot about the damage mankind is doing to the sea, the rubbish, the plastic. So this is my take, weaving in the myth and legend of some of the things that perhaps we as human beings need to answer for. It's called Old Man of the Sea. Sing me no siren song, no tales of Lorelei. Soft pink women, as slippery as fish, flexible as eels. They slide with an enticing flop out of waved tossed dreams and into the waiting reality of sea, solid and grey as lead, reeking of ozone and beached seaweed. Waves roll with the punch of the wind, which has come a long way to get here, carrying memories of old deaths in its spume-flecked lungs. Oil slicks hunt for seabirds, flaunting false rainbows as bait, and factory-sized flotillas of waste circle the currents, having nothing better to do. The water heaves and heaves again, spewing up an old man, tentacle-haired and dripping, eyes dulled by depth, blind witness to fathoms, his breath hissing lost oceans. Barnacles cling to him like repeated lies, scraping roughly on the rocks as he drags himself forward, skin raw and mottled as an old trout. The tail that finally levers him forward, thrashing and gasping out of legend and onto dry land, is as broad and stubborn as a whale's. Do not approach him. He has questions he wants answered.
And The Submerged Sea by J.S. Watts is published by Dempsey and Windle. Our guest on, studio guest on Bookmark today is Ruth Figgis, talking about her debut novel, Magnetism, which very much focuses down on this mother-daughter relationship, Ruth, the ebbs and flows of it, the highs and lows. Where did that relationship come from?
Well, I think I think you've got to write about the things that are meaningful to you and the possibilities for emotion. So I think that this is a real, as you said, a rich theme for us to write about, and I hope that I've portrayed it with a compassion towards both the mother and the daughter in this relationship.
Well, yes, I wanted to know that. Where was your sympathy? Where did your sympathy lie, with Erica, the daughter, or Caroline, the mother?
Well, I hope with both of them. It's told in the first person from the daughter's point of view, but there's something about the lack of understanding about your parents that I wanted to explore, and I want the reader to have a much more awareness, or I hope the reader has more awareness of the mother's situation than the daughter does at times. And although she's quite mysterious, I want sympathy. I want people to have sympathy for both of them.
Yeah, I mean, they're both tricky characters.
They are.
Aren't
they? They are. They are really. They are. They're not. They're unique. I think I'd like to think of them. They are proper characters, but I think they're rounded and they are flawed. They're both flawed, and they're both short-sighted as well.
Yes, and you can see where one ends, you know, where one becomes the other.
Yeah.
What the mother gives to the daughter and vice versa. Yeah. It's a very female-centred novel. I mean, there are men in it, but they are viewed through the female lens.
Yeah, I think it's a book that may well appeal to women much more than men. A couple of men who've read it have been surprised at how much they've enjoyed it. The men are not big in the book, other than the father, and I hope the father's a sympathetic character as well.
Well, the father, yes, and we learn more as the book goes on, and we go further back in time about the secret he's been keeping, which is quite explosive. Was that always the case? We're not going to give too much away.
Yeah.
But was that secret always there for you when you wrote him?
Yes. The mother's keeping secrets as well. So, yes, that was always the case. But I wanted the reader to discover it in the same, in a light way, that it's not a heavy-handed secret, but it's just there. And it has impact upon the whole story.
Yes. And it is one of those books that once you finish, you want to start again because you can see, you know, how the knowledge that you have as you've progressed through the book permeates the beginning, if you know what I mean. Right, we'll have your second choice of music now, which is Joan Baez. The President sang Amazing Grace. Why this one?
Well, I heard this fairly recently, and I was, again, very moved by this piece of music. And I think it's... Well, the speech he gave before he sang, so it's about President Obama singing Amazing Grace at a eulogy for a reverend who was killed in America in 2015. And it was striking that he actually just stopped and then sang. I was really impressed with that. So Zoe Mulford wrote this song about it and Joan Baez covered it.
A young man came to a house of prayer. They did not ask what brought him there. He was not friend, he was not kin, but they opened the door and let him in. And for an hour the stranger stayed. He sat with them and he seemed to pray. But then the young man drew a gun and killed 9 people, old and young. In Charleston, in the month of June.
Bookmark with Lee Chambers on Cambridge 105 Radio.
With Heffer's Bookshop, the great Cambridge bookseller since 1876.
Our aspirations, rather than books.
Yes, you're listening to Bookmark on Cambridge 105 Radio with me, Lee Chambers, and our studio guest today is Ruth Figgis, talking about her debut novel, Magnetism. And you're going to read an extract
of
it for us now, Ruth.
This is chapter 6, 1999. It's called The Weasel. It's the beginning of it anyway. It's been a jam-packed flight, and with a last-minute booking, I got a bad seat assignment. I was positioned next to a woman with 2 rug rats that cried continually, and right in front of some fourth-grade monster who spent most of the journey kicking the back of my seat. Though I'm premenstrual, headachy and feeling grimy as we finally exit the plane, I walk along the concourse feeling freer with every step. I'm hoping that, because I was late checking in, my bag might be one of the first onto the conveyor belt, so it won't be too long to wait. It's May, the beginning of the summer, and through the glass I sense the familiar dry Phoenix heat. It'll be a good 10 degrees hotter than Oklahoma out there, and I'm excited that I will see my mother soon, and I know that this is a good thing to do. In fact, it'll be a relief to see her, and healthy for me to have some vacation time, a fresh start. And then something really does go right. It's no wait at all. The 10th suitcase that drops through the flaps is mine, and when I come out of the baggage collection, there she is, waving madly and right in front of me. She looks different. When we hug, her body feels as though the stuffing has been removed, and her hair smells like a health food store. Since I last saw her, she must have dropped 30 pounds. Her face is pale, gaunt and wrinkly. It's always nearly impossible to get facts from her when we're face to face, but when it's only her voice down the phone line, I have no idea what's happening, and she's been exceptionally evasive lately. She's got too much insurance to be sick and is too young to be senile, but I've worked out that once this guy Philip came on the scene, she began giving up all her friends. A couple of months ago, she explained that she felt she had to abandon some stuff. It's important to do things together. My friends bore him, she said. In fact, it sounds as if she doesn't actually do anything anymore, and he's there all the time. It's as though my mother is fading away, or turning into someone else, someone I don't recognize. Seeing her appearance now doesn't help. It's not like I don't know he's important in her life, but when we walk out from the airport to the parking lot, hand in hand, and she points him out, I'm still shocked to see someone else sitting behind the wheel of Mom's car. Is that him? Is that Philip? He came with you, and you let him drive your car. It's nice to be the passenger. Since when are you the passenger? I'm thinking about getting one of those Subarus. You love your Malibu. We've always bought Chevrolet. Dad always liked Chevrolet. Your dad didn't know a thing about cars, and things change. We have to move on. Then as we get close to the car, she tells me to deal with your face. No one wants to look at your miserable expression, honey, trying to look happy. First impressions are important. Aren't they just, I think. How could she have neglected to tell me about all that facial hair? When this guy does his version of a smile, you can only really tell because a dark pink hole opens up between the overgrown mustache and the grubby grey beard. His teeth look yellow. He doesn't get out to help with loading my bag into the trunk or even to open the door for Mom. I climb into the back seat. Mom, I've always loved this car. Why would you replace it? I don't know why you'd think of changing it. It drives okay. I remember how we went together to buy it, and the salesman helped us out with a good deal because Mom charmed him and played up the fact that she was recently widowed. She did that for a long time, telling everyone she met about the shocking tragedy of losing her husband, adding flourishes to the story, reducing the truth with every telling, and expecting me to play along. We argued on the way home from the lot, knowing that the car we were going to collect the next day was going to be $1,000 cheaper than the showroom price, that it would be specially cleaned, the tank filled, and that she had an extended guarantee for exactly no cost but her appreciation. She explained that it wasn't because she'd manipulated him, it was because men always find vulnerable women appealing. It brings out that knight in shining armour that they all want to be, and you might want to think about that for yourself. You have no idea how to behave around men. You batter decent people with your nasty mouth and scare men away. You could learn something. Even your father wanted to save the day, she said. I was missing Dad, and still angry. I said, what do you mean? He was what he was. I held up my end of the deal, 150%. I said that he'd have done anything to make her happy. He was always trying, but she was forever running off somewhere. Whatever it he got out of the relationship but a lot of heartache. She shook her head and said that she refused to dignify my question with an answer. There's lots you don't know, she said, and you wouldn't understand what it was like. Try me. That's it, she said. Enough. My life, my marriage, is none of your business. Now, as we leave the parking lot, Philip waits while Mom and I dig around in our purses to come up with payment. So this guy is also a cheapskate. I'm quicker than Mom, and I pass forward the $4. The springs in the back seat beneath me ping as I shift my weight. They're worn out, and the engine doesn't really sound great. The car, I guess, really is very old now, but she's always taken care of it. I wonder how that guy Randall, who used to deal with the car, is feeling now that this Philip is hanging around. If she has to replace the car, she could get another Malibu. Randall would have recommended an updated Chevrolet, not some foreign car. I settle back again. You know, Americans have a duty to buy American, Mom. That's a very narrow-minded view, Philip says, looking directly at me in the rearview mirror. It's a global economy and we need to think about the environment. Other manufacturers do a better job. I give him my meanest don't-mess-with-me stare, the one that should have worked on the 12-year-old on the plane, until he chooses to look at the road again rather than risk an accident. This is not a great start.
It's not a great start. It doesn't get much better, really, does it? He's a piece of work. He is. Philip.
He is.
Interesting. That extract pulls together quite a lot of the themes of the book. One thing that does keep coming back, women's relationship with themselves, this idea of plastic surgery. There's a lot about food, eating, weight. That's obviously an area you wanted to explore.
Yeah, I think women's, women and their bodies is an issue. And in the environment of this story, plastic surgery is not an uncommon thing. So I think that's quite interesting too, how we, constantly are pressed to fix ourselves and in the end, we're still getting older.
Yes, and there is something, because it's told backwards, you've got the contrast of ageing, whereas to the reader, in some ways, they're actually growing younger.
Yes, I think that's quite an interesting thing too, and you see how hopeful and there's a plastic surgery in the beginning of the book and nearer the end of the book as well.
Well, let's hear from a young woman now, Aphrodita Nikolova. She's a Poetry Slam champion for Macedonia. Her poetry was included in the publication Young Macedonian Avant-Garde Poetry and in the anthology Glass Cases and Curious, amongst many others. Over the years, she's expressed an interest in the poetry of witness, and I asked her to tell me more about that.
So the poetry of witness is a term coined by Caroline Forché, an American poet. She edited a Norton anthology called Against Forgetting. I think, in short, poetry of witness is we as poets, as readers, as people, putting our own self in as a witness to other people's experiences.
And how would that look on the page? How would that feel different to another poem?
I'm not entirely sure. I think that in that sense, you can say that every, inverted commas, good poem is poetry of witness. I think poetry of witness is more about the event of reading and being with the poem rather than a certain poem being a poem of witness.
And you are Macedonian?
Yes.
Originally. How much does that influence what you write?
I come from Macedonia, but also I come from an Aromanian family. Aromanians are a group of people across the Balkans. They have, like, some people think, Latinized background. This idea of having different sense of selves, like nationality or ethnicity, and being a student here in England has massively influenced my writing. I use my background to explore it and to abandon my childhood, as the Macedonian poet Nikola Madurov likes to talk about his poetry. So it's abandoning my childhood, it's abandoning my background. Poetry is a way of leaving that behind in order to embrace it and embrace the universal. Another example of that is the Canadian poet and novelist Anne Michaels. I think, like, her almost like unseeming presence in her writing, but also like in the poetry scene, or is very elusive, but also very immediate at the same time. That's what I'm striving for.
And you're particularly interested in spoken word. Why? Why spoken word?
I think I read somewhere, like, it's a very multifaceted beast because it can mean so many different things to different people, like anything else. I arrived at it just very naively, just wanted to try it out. I thought it might be fun to try out different way of doing poetry. I was skeptical about it. But why spoken word appeals to me, it's an environment that stresses performance, the live aspect of it. The second one that follows maybe from the life aspect of it is the relationality and the communal spirit. And the third one, and perhaps one of the most important one that is afforded by these two, it provides a way of becoming for participants, which is non-judgmental or strives to be non-judgmental, and it's forgiving until it's not. If that makes sense. So, for example, if you go in a spoken word setting or a poetry slam, or what originally is the competitive art form of spoken word, you can use any types of words. And as, like, Kai Miller, like a British poet, likes to joke or critique this form, you can rhyme love with dove and just spill your emotions. But at the same time, you get some support to express yourself. But following that ritual, you can move on and reinvent yourself as a person and then potentially as an artist or as a poet as well.
Some people might find it a little bit exposing, a little bit frightening.
Generally, writing in any sort of way, people find it that way. There was one poem that we looked at recently at workshops in Wolfson College by D'Souza, a great poet who... she has a very short poem where she says, like, don't look for the autobiographical in my poetry. You're not going to find it. But I guess what that really means is that you distill experiences and emotions that obviously are always going to be yours, but also not. So it is intimidating to do that, and it is revealing, but at the same time, that's what makes the vulnerability so great, where strength also comes from.
And I suppose when you write a poem and you know you're going to read it aloud, you're looking for some differences between what you might put on a poetry on the page and some similarities. Looking for rhythms, cadences, tempo.
I used to think of these processes originally as different, but now I'm not so sure, and I think they're not different, actually. Or maybe I'm just not aware. I don't self-monitor. I just do it as an artist, I guess. Patience Agbabi has a poem, and I quote her on this. She says, "Give me a page and I'll perform on it. Give me a stage and I'll cut form on it." And I feel like she's trying to capture like the continuum and the fluidity and dynamics of what it takes to navigate the page and the stage, which is not to say I'm underestimating the role of being live and the rhythm. You can have equally like a poem written for the page with this type of liveness to it, and the other way around. I write poetry. Some of it is just exciting, live, and some of it is more intimate to be on the page.
And are there particular subjects you like to cover in your poetry?
A friend gave me Ocean Wong's poetry book entitled A Night Sky with Exit Wounds for my last birthday. I was blown away by that book, as most of people are in the poetry world. But I just read how somebody summarized the themes in that book, which was femininity, violence, family, intimacy, sexuality. And I was like, yes, yes. Those are more or less some of the themes that my work also looks at, and I guess also love in any form.
And how have you found the poetry scene in Cambridge?
I do have lots of opinions about the poetry scene in Cambridge, given that I have now been in Cambridge for 4 years, and I was really excited to discover and just understand and be a part of it. This is what I love about the poetry scene in Cambridge. It's very friendly and welcoming, and it's also very homely in a sense. Like, there's a community spirit where once you learn the poetry gigs and the events, you can easily create a sense of belonging into it. That said, I find that there's slightly maybe a division between the university poetry events and the local ones. I worked as an external officer as part of the Gates Cambridge Council, and I tried to like organize events bridging like university communities and local ones, and just in general and outside Cambridge. So that's, I guess, one thing. And another one, I think there's always a lack of poetry. More poetry is always good for me.
Are you a Gates scholar?
Yeah.
So tell me what being a Gates scholar means.
Apart from the imposter syndrome that everybody talks about here in Cambridge, which is like a buzzword, a jargon we use. Oh, I don't belong here. Like,
well, the fear of being caught out.
The fear of being caught out then, maybe. Because, you know, like the Gates Cambridge Scholarship, it has its own like prestige and name, like the university as well. When you strip out all those layers of potential outward perception, honestly, what it really means, it means you have the safe space and access to knowledge and resources to just do what I love doing and what I believe. And one of the tenets of it is to contribute to the lives of others. And Rika has a book, The Self as Another. So I guess doing good for others is doing good for yourself and the other way around.
But you're the first Gates scholar from Macedonia.
Yes, that was unexpected and exhilarating because it was a competitive process. I felt very lucky, and I thought it's also great that Macedonia was included in it as well.
And you've got some poetry to read now. And this is modern poetry. You're reading it from your phone. Is that how you read poetry at a slam, from your phone?
For performance, I usually just know the poem by heart. I like the poem to be in me. It's not that this one's not in me as well. This one is more of a poem that I wrote for the page, but it's a poem called In the Gusts of Wind. Here is the mirror you're looking for. This dewy glass in which a god reflects itself. Forgive me, you will say to yourself, in front of the end's bridge at the heart of this wild growth. Look, a shadow of a snail's shell covers the mark of the grass which separates it from the untouched stalk. See, a wild thyme. Maybe the silver trails of this flower are invisible to the eye, but the sun inlays them in my hand as a mother of pearl in a frame of a mirror. We will talk about the truth for hours. But here, now everything's predictable. The barley's decision to flower is a decision to die. Here the rain returns to the birds in the hollows of the road. In the park a baby is feeding on its mother's breast and reading the swallow's flight above her heads even before it learns to say, Mum, I know what you're going to say even before your lip tilts in the direction we send the dead. You are right. In the gusts of wind, no one is safe. but the nights keep moving as if nothing is a secret.
And that was Aphrodita Nikolova. We're coming to the end of our time on Bookmark with you, Ruth Figgest, sadly. But what's next for you? This was your debut novel.
Yeah, I'm working on something else. It's based in where I was born, in Oxford. And it's about two-thirds of the way through, maybe three-quarters of the way through. So I'm going to plough on and finish that.
And you're teaching as well, is that right?
Yeah, I teach a couple of groups of people creative writing, and I enjoy doing that enormously.
And you yourself have this MA in creative writing. What difference did that make to you?
I enjoyed doing the course enormously. I think it actually made me focus on being a writer. I've always wanted to be an author, so it gave me kind of a license in a way to do that.
And Magnetism, we've been talking about today, by Ruth Figgest. It's published by Myriad Editions, a small press who punch way above their weight. What's it been like working with them?
They are a fantastic publishing house. I have felt supported and encouraged, and I'm so pleased they're publishing it, and I think they're great.
And what's your writing day like now? Is this is what you do now? Is it?
Yeah, I still work part time, but I have the freedom of working flexible hours, so that's great. I like to write in the morning before all the creative energy gets sucked away into other things. So my writing is mainly done in the morning, and then sometimes late at night when I like to do some editing.
And are you still writing short stories?
I still write short stories. I like to have more than one thing on the go at the same time. I dread getting bored. Also, if you get stuck with something, you can go on to do something else. So there's lots of things to write about, lots of things to explore in the writing. So I'm enjoying doing lots of different things.
Because the novel, actually, almost each chapter could be a short story,
yeah,
couldn't it?
Indeed.
Am I right in thinking that you actually submitted some of the chapters as short stories into competition?
Yeah, the one of the chapters that was highly commended in 2017 for the Bridport is one of the chapters in the book. It's been edited since, but so yes, they can, most of them can stand alone.
Because they're sort of self-contained.
They do have a beginning, middle, and end, and they're in the same time frame, which is what you need to do with the short story, I think.
And often looking at a particular moment as well, as a short story is. We'll finish by asking you a question that we ask all the guests here on Bookmark. What are you reading at the moment?
I've just finished reading The Party by Elizabeth Day. I enjoyed it enormously. It was a real pull-along novel, just... and it was artfully done.
It's an excellent book, isn't it?
Yeah. It really was good, yeah.
And what's lined up? Have you got what's next on your pile by your bed? Can you remember that?
I've just also finished reading The Terranauts, and somebody recommended a book to me that I want to read. I always have a pile of books, so I'm on the go with books all the time.
You're on the go. That's good. That's what we like to hear. Well, a heads up that our next Bookmark, there's kind of war and conflict theme to our next Bookmark. The studio guest is Derek Nyman. He'll be talking about his book, A Nazi in the Family, which examines, as you might imagine, his family history. We'll also hear from Philip Walker talking about his book, Behind the Lawrence Legend, which looks at the men who, along with Lawrence of Arabia, shaped the Arab Revolt. And Claire Mully, who's a friend of this show. She's updating us on what's happened to her and the book since the publication of The Women Who Flew for Hitler. There's some fantastic events in the meantime at our sponsors, Heffer's Bookshop. On May the 1st, Roland Phillips tells the full story of the Russian spy Donald MacLean when he talks about his book, A Spy Named Orphan. And May the 3rd, Stefan Collini, who is also featured on Bookmark, will be talking about his new book, Speaking of Universities, an analysis of the changes and challenges facing academia. So if you're interested in either of those events, then get along to the Heffers website, which is heffers.co.uk. I'll also recommend to you the Cambridge 105 website, which is cambridge105.co.uk. And you can find there not just all the old episodes of Bookmark, going right back to the beginning of time almost, but podcasts of all the shows we do on this wonderful station about films and food and all the different kinds of music. So you might just want to explore that website. We are going to sign out now with your last choice of music, Ruth, which is a Cavalleria Rusticana. Have I said that? The intermezzo from that is Mozart.
No, it's It's gone from my head for the minute.
People can Google this. Yeah. Why this one?
This one I discovered, well, I didn't really discover it because when I heard it, I knew I'd heard it before. But a friend of mine, Judy, wrote it about her watching her father listen to it. And I was so moved by the writing that another friend gave me a copy of this. And then I was moved by the music as well. So that's why that's there.